This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program for the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
My name is Nicholas Meyer, director of Star Trek 2 and 6, and you are listening to Standard Orbit on Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Now in standard orbit, sir.
Welcome, everyone, to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Ken Tripp.
I am Zach Moore.
And I'm Haley Stoddart. Today we are taking a look at one of the magazines that I was gifted over Christmas from my cousin. This topic of this particular issue is Ken's favorite film and version of our beloved ship, the motion picture and the refit Enterprise. So I posited to you guys a list of topics from some of those magazines and Ken was like, refit! Hands down.
Yeah, I was like a little kid. Thank you, Haley, for putting all this together. And Zach, he kind of rogered up pretty quick, too, about the topic. So we've done a few different shows on Standard Orbit about the movie. We've done a show about starships holistically. Actually, our biggest downloaded episode ever was Red Shirt Starship. And then I've talked to Paul Olson, who actually was the painter of the model of the Enterprise for TMP. So we've kind of talked all around it, but I don't think we've ever specifically had a show about the ship. What's changed? What did they do? How did they come up with the idea? So when you put that together, Haley, yeah, I was real excited. In fact, I almost skipped over your introductions just to start getting into the meat of this thing because I'm really pumped, but love this ship. What were your thoughts, Zach, when we started this thing?
Yeah, well, first of all, Haley, that's an awesome Christmas present you got. I remember back in the day, I used to get Star Trek the magazine. I actually have most of them, I think, in storage. I will pull them out one day. it's a climate-controlled storage, guys, so don't worry. They're in good condition. But, yeah, that was a really cool magazine. It was kind of like the internet before the internet. I mean, think about it. This is the early 2000s. People still have dial-up. You know, you don't have things like Memory Alpha or all these resources and articles and interviews and pictures and all that. So Star Trek the magazine was really slick, really well put together too. It's like bigger than a normal magazine, so it's kind of hard to fit on shelves, but it's like glossy, so it's like really high production value. So it was a really great thing they were putting out back in the day. And I love the refit Enterprise. It's my favorite Enterprise, my favorite spaceship. So I'm looking forward to talking about it here today.
And I'm interested, Haley, from your opinion. If funny thing was when we were doing Red Shirt Starship, and it may have had the longest feed on the Babel conference at the time. There's probably been some that usurped it, but it went on for days and days. And it was very interesting to me that when we were asking the questions, you know, men in particular had a lot of very strong opinions on their ships and whatnot. And women had a very different view of how they looked at the starships. And I still remember Amy in particular. You know, it was more along functionality and comfort, not so much design and things. What just out of curiosity, where do you kind of land when you look at the different Enterprises? Does the ship really mean a lot to you or not? I mean, I know your Twitter handle would indicate that it does, but I'm just curious.
You know, I'm middle ground on this. I like how it looks. I like the design, the overall design, but I think to some degree it's also the interior too. So it's not just those beautiful exterior shots that really pull me in, but some of those interior shots and exactly how it functions, how it works and stuff. I'm very logical, rational, but I also like the leak of them. I really do. Ship-wise, I think they're really important. I mean, it is a character in itself. And it makes me sad. I mean, I didn't grow up with the original series and it's my second favorite, but I cry every time like something happens to the ship and it's like getting destroyed, you know, in the Kelvin films. I'm like, oh, this is really sad. Like, and Beyond, well, when it got, oh my gosh, that sequence with Beyond and those hive ships, that just broke my heart. That was sad.
Everybody just needs to calm down. There are plenty of letters left in the alphabet. Okay.
Yes. Yes, there are, for sure. So I'm sure there's a lot of people, a lot of our listeners who know a lot of the details of the differences in the how much of this, in reading over kind of what I typed up, Ken, did you know?
You know,
where the refit is your favorite.
Yeah. Well, at the time, Haley, back in 79, before some of my friends here on this show ever existed, I had these incredible blueprints. And
oh, the blueprint story. Yes.
The blueprint story. And one of the things that I regret more than anything in certain aspects is, you know, when I was a kid, we didn't collect. We played with things and we showed off things and we brought it to school with us. And, you know, things get stained, destroyed over time. You know, that's just how things were. It's amazing to me how people are so meticulous today when they get these things, how well they take care of it. I was not one of those people. But I studied this ship like you wouldn't believe because, you know, the movie really was as much about the Enterprise as anything else, right? And that's probably why a lot of people didn't like it as much as others, because it didn't focus as much on the characters. It was a lot about the ship and its functionality and everything just seemed to have a purpose and a point. And all of that got lost in the ensuing movies and series and so forth, where it wasn't as regimented as it was on the motion picture. So for me, I really got into it. Now, when you put all the discussion notes together and I started looking at it again, it brought back a lot of memories because I had forgotten, you know, how much it increased in size or why they did this or why they did that. I just remember studying and understanding what was on each deck, what each person's mission was performing on the bridge, all of that stuff as a kid I was really into. So, and just the ultimate design, I thought it was just, the way that they painted the ship, the way they had the look of the ship, it never looked better, and it's never looked better since the motion picture. It just hasn't. They have not matched the level of scale and the beauty of capturing that model. Even with the new CGI, they have not been able to create another ship. I don't care which one. Doesn't matter if it's an Enterprise or an alien ship or whatever. They've never been able to match that quality and that beauty of that ship.
What are your thoughts, Zach?
Yeah, like, I had no idea what deck the Engineering was on the Enterprise. I mean, TNG, I knew it was Deck 36. I think they say that a lot, but I actually never had remembered or recalled or looked up that it was on Deck 19, apparently, on the original series Enterprise, movie Enterprise. So stuff like that's interesting. And the thing about the, you know, different things like where the name and then registry number are and those kind of things, I never really looked at, like, A to B comparison of what had changed between the refit and the original. It's almost a totally new Enterprise, right? So it really is.
Yeah. So I was flipping through the magazine and there was a short little section of some of the changes. And then there was a longer article that I read. And it was really interesting to find out. I mean, it does. It increases from 289 meters to 305. Like, that's a sizable difference, right? You know, it's new hull plating. Obviously, I mean, the nacelles are quite different.
Yeah, I think that the nacelles are what makes it a bit longer. Mm-hmm. I think because they're at a more of an angle, it kind of goes back a little further. Plus, I don't know, the saucer might be bigger. I'm not sure if that's in here or not, but. But little, I mean, that's what is that like? That's, let's do some quick math here. 11 plus 5 is 6. So 16 meters longer than the original Enterprise. Six, that's, you know, when you're talking big ships, 16 meters is nothing. Am I right?
It's not that significant. It's not. But it's, you know, I always multiply by three. I know a meter is a little bit more than a yard. And that's, you know, when I think in terms of ships, I always think in terms of feet because that's what I'm used to. And so, I mean, the ship is roughly, it's roughly 1,000 feet long, which, you know, in today's world is a little shorter than an aircraft carrier, but it's a pretty good sized ship, right?
Yeah. Well, and I liked the fact that they added a recreation deck.
Yeah, you didn't like the rec rooms? The windowless glorified briefing rooms we had in the original series? That wasn't good enough for you?
No, come on now. We need game time, right? I mean, we were talking off mic about playing board games and stuff. I mean, the crew needs that.
This device serves no purpose, Haley. Okay, like, I like the rec deck. It's like probably the coolest set on the motion picture. Most impressive, I think.
Yeah, engineering by far. But what I like about the rec deck is, and what its point was in the film, was to be able to assemble the entire crew, right? And that's important. You know, on ships that are not in space, you can do that on the flight deck or the quarter deck. You can get the teams together. You can have ceremonies. You can have all those things. And that was just something that, you know, on the original Enterprise, and probably even on the D, it's like, where would you put all those people to have a formation or, you know, to recognize or to give someone an award or to, you know, just to give a brief? Those things happen on ships. Actually, it's quite common. So for me, I thought that was the neatest point. And the fact that it was, what, three decks high, something like that, because you had people up above looking down, and it was really cool. It really did a nice job. I mean, it was a beautiful set. Don't get me wrong, Zach. I just thought, for me, the most impressive set that has been ever built, I think, across Star Trek and has been rebuilt several times was that engineering deck. I mean, that was incredible. Even doesn't seem dated to me at all when I see it today.
Yeah. So that, I mean, we've talked a little bit about the nacelles. They're a little different.
Do you guys like the nacelles from the original series or the movies better? What do you guys
movies.
Think?
All the movies.
Yeah, definitely the movies.
I thought it was interesting that when they went to the TNG era, right, they kind of went back to the cell caps and of the original series, you know, because we had the, I always call them like the stripe nacelles from the movies, you know, the Enterprise, Reliant, the Excelsior, they have the same look of nacelles in the 2270s and 80s, I guess that was in. And then they get retro again in the 24th century and they go back to the buzzard collectors, right?
Did you say buzzard?
Buzzard collectors. I have the TNG technical manual, and those things are called buzzard collectors.
I for some reason, I guess in my head, I always I know it's mentioned. No. I guess maybe because of I do remember in Insurrection they did call it out. I just thought it was Bizarre or something like that, but I didn't realize it was buzzard.
It's the Riker maneuver, man. Yeah, they use that in TNG. There's an episode of TNG where they use that once too, and I don't know. I always thought that was kind of weird. I'm sure that was not their function on the original series. There might be some retcons, right? Some novel somewhere where they use the cell caps for that purpose. But I think in the original series, it's like, let's just have something like red, has like a light on it. That looks cool. Put that on there, you know? So I doubt they were called buzzer collectors in the TOS era.
Probably not.
Yeah. But yeah, I like the movie Nacelles as well. So,
well, and they are more angled than they were in the original series. So you were right on that, Zach. And you're also correct. The saucer section is a little bit wider in the refit. Because they wanted more internal space. So it is wider.
Now, to me, I'm like, outside the universe, fine, I get it, right? But you know, in universe, it's like, all right, how do I justify this is the same Enterprise? I thought, okay, maybe they like keep the saucer section, right? And they eject like the bridge module, and they put a new bridge module on, and they eject the nacelles, and they put some new nacelles on, right? And you're like, okay, then maybe that I can buy that it's the same ship. But when you're talking about like a bigger saucer section, like what do they do? They built more decks around the sides, you know? I'm just trying to, I don't know. That's fine. It's just when you try to think about like, I mean, there's no money in the 20th century, whatever. But how cost effective is it to? It's like, are you gonna keep fixing this old car, are you going to just buy a new car at this point? You know, I don't know. Like, stuff like that really, like, I had always assumed the Saucer was the same size. And then we started talking about, like, looking at the numbers here you put together and talking about how much bigger the ship is. I'm like, well, I guess that's bigger. And it is. And to me, that's weird that the Saucer is bigger. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that it's interesting. Sometimes, you know, you might have a very small portion of the ship that is original, a deck plating area here or there, because they want to keep, especially if the ship is historical and they don't want to tear it up. But essentially, you know, you can gut, replace, rebuild almost from scratch, you know, a ship. And so when they say it's almost an entirely new Enterprise, it's like, I can't see what isn't new at all. So it could be something very internal and something very small, you know, in order to say, yep, this is still, there's still a part of this ship that's still here, you know. And there's a lot of, if you go to, like, the USS New York is actually built from the steel from the World Trade Centers. You know, they did that as a way to memorialize, you know, those buildings and things. So you can take pieces and parts and so forth and kind of keep things intact so that you can have this this legacy, you know, so the Enterprise is still the Enterprise. So when people come aboard, it's like, you know, they, even though it's a very small percentage, they can say this was the famous ship that did the first 5-year mission, all this other stuff, and, you know, it's completely modernized. So I do hear what you're saying. I think that that's probably where they were going. If not, that's definitely what's in my head, because you're right. It doesn't make much sense. The ship in the motion picture captures a lot of details that no one even really bothered to try to go after in the original series. I mean, they really didn't, you know, how things work. You know, you never really see where the torpedoes come out of, where the phasers come out of, all that other stuff in the TV show. And all of this is very clear, you know, in the movie. So I hear what you're saying. Yeah, I think that expanding and lengthening, you know, they do that when they do refits on ships today, but I would say, you know, they don't change 99% of the ship, which is what they definitely did in the motion picture.
Well, and we'll get to that in a little bit, because there was an article about the redesigning of it, and I found it really, really interesting. So we'll kind of hint to some of why it changed so much. So stay tuned for that. But so I think the coolest thing for me about, we'll talk about the bridge and then we'll get to your favorite section, Ken. We'll talk about main engineering. There were turbo lock armrests on the bridge now.
No one's going flying, huh?
Nope. No one's going to go flying anymore. You can engage those turbo lock armrests if
turbo
you need to.
Turbo lock armrests. So that's, yeah. Is that a technical term?
That's what it said in the magazine. It said turbo lock armrest. So, like, when the ship's at warp, and I guess if it's going too fast or something happens, you're not. It's like a seatbelt, but it's on your arm.
If you get sucked into a wormhole because your warp drive's not working right, you just put on your turbo lock armrest and you're good. So
yep.
No, yeah, no, like that is a cool design, because everybody's like, why are there seatbelts on the Enterprise? It's like, well, here's an answer to all your criticisms, people, and that's genius, because you're not gonna, like, strap in. This isn't NASA. You know, but I mean, I think, you know, that's a really cool idea to have them, like, kind of fit over your thighs, and you're kind of locked in, that's turbo locked into your chair. So that is a really cool design, which they lost when they got to the Marriott in space, the Enterprise D. They just, everybody's just hanging out in their chairs, flying around, all that kind of thing. But the turbo lock armrest, that definitely, that's a great, there you go. That's the, Haley's doing the Star Trek stagger and shake. But yeah, that is a really smart design there for the bridge. And also the two turbo lifts, huh?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. I know. Well, and I...
Who's been holding up the damn elevator, right? There's only I can't believe there's only one access point, right, to your command center. Like, if that's compromised, then you're kind of screwed. So it makes perfect sense that there'd be more than one turbo lift. And that was even from the animated series. You know, they had two turbo lifts on the animated series. I think it's in a different spot. But that's the whole place of the animated series and the continuity here has always been kind of in question. I count it as canon, so I have my own fanboy justifications for how that works. But regardless, more than one turbo lift, definitely the way to go to the bridge.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think that makes way more sense than just the one. So yeah, that one was kind of nice too. Anything catch your eye, Ken?
Well, I was thinking of now I'm going to call my seatbelts turbo lock seatbelts. I just like that term. I think that's pretty cool. I don't remember that term until seeing it here bulleted out that that's what they called it. But that's pretty cool. Well, the whole bridge itself is much more sensible and practical than it had ever been. Like I said, each station had a real function, and they really got into the Natsas detail on that. You know, I mean, they had, you know, a weapons and security station makes perfect sense. The comm station, the science station, the environmental controls, engineering, navigation, and helm, you know, all of it had just a perfect reason and design like you would have, not so much on the bridge of a ship, but you would have in a combat information center. You know, you'd have all those different sections around. And it's funny because that original bridge design from the Enterprise has been copied so often as because of its practicality. Right, where things work, how things should operate. It really was a beautiful, masterful design as to how you would probably have a bridge or a CIC or whatever in space. It really did, and I just thought the motion picture, you know, took it to a whole new level. It's funny when you see movies like Star Wars and other things where, you know, you're on the Star Destroyer and you're like, who does what? You know, I mean, and it's huge. It's absolutely massive. And as you watch Star Trek kind of evolve, the design of the Enterprise Bridge, whether original series or in the TOS movies or whatever, probably doesn't really come back into play as much until you get onto the Defiant, where it's really practical. You know, you don't want to be shouting orders across a big expanse. You want to make sure everybody can clearly hear what's being said to one station to the other, and it needs to be kind of compact. And you certain is, you know, like having people behind you in critical stations like weapons and things like that, it doesn't work very well.
Fire.
Just doesn't.
What?
Yeah.
Fire.
You want to be sure things will work, or at least you can spin your chair and you can face those folks. So if you think about it, they just took what I thought was a really cool design, upgraded it nicely, but the focus on the detail of these such things, I mean, I really enjoy, but it does take, I mean, it's almost like, well, you focus so much on this, what about the actual plot and storyline and other things and characters? And that's what kind of, you know, what I loved about the movie is a lot of things that people didn't like. It's like, well, that's not really all that important. What's important is this or the plot or this or that. And I thought they captured it all very well in the movie, but I do understand a lot of people are like, man, This was incredible. It's like this thing is completely real. And I think that helped me suspend disbelief even more, because the more practical it is and the more I can envision something working, the more I can escape into that reality.
Yeah, and I think it was great because the bridge became, the functionality of it became better, right? I mean, you've got weapons control is separate from helm now rather than both, which, yeah, exactly. It's, you know, and that's very practical and makes sense. I will say some people were standing. They did not have chairs to spin around in, but they lost their chairs.
Yeah, like the guy with the glowing eyes, who was like, "What about Captain Decker?" Blah, blah, blah. Like, he doesn't have a chair; he's just standing around most of the time. Like, you see the ship shaking; he's like, has to hold on to like the wall. It's like, oh, that poor guy. But hey, Worf didn't get a chair for 7 years on Next Generation. So. The senior officer, he's got a whole. They finally gave him a chair in Generation, so I'm not really getting a chance to see it very much. But he does have a chair back there. But.
Yeah, Decker had nothing either, right? Because he was
wandering around from station to station.
Yeah, he literally was. I mean, he was just standing back there because of the way, you know, that wasn't what it was designed to be.
Well, he's supposed to have the captain's chair.
That's right.
Kicks him out. Then he's like science officer, like, okay. And then Spock shows up. He's like, well, all right, I guess I'm going to get up from here. Yeah. And then he's just wandering around the rest of the time. I
know. If it went to 4 hours, I wonder how many other jobs he would have been relieved from. It's kind of funny. Yeah, kind of a rough day.
This is my favorite bridge, I think, and I like that little. Does anybody know what the green dome is at the top of this bridge? You know, like the little half circle, half sphere, I should say. And now in the animated series, It's interesting. It was some kind of bridge self-defense. That's what it reminded me of. And I think, yeah. I believe it's in Beyond the Farthest Star, the first episode of the animated series, that they have like a bridge self-defense thing and like a little like phasers come down, which is brilliant, I think, you know, if you're trying to protect your command center from hostiles taking over. But that's what I always kind of thought it was. I think that's kind of cool. Now, I don't know what the original Enterprise was supposed to have up there. Like, you know, like the D has its little window, which is cool. But
well, the original Enterprise had a window too, because they would...
Well, that's right. The zoom in. Yeah. The zoom classic in, yes. Zoom in from the cage. Established, right. In the very first episode. Very good.
Right.
Now, we got to see that from the outside. We never had the budget to point up at the ceiling on the original series set. I mean, because they never built one. But yeah, I forgot about that. So anyway... I don't know what that little green orb is. I don't think it's ever been itemized or anything, but I think it's pretty cool. And I like the subdued colors of the bridge, right? Because even the original series, I like the cage version of the bridge better, because it's not like an eyesore. Like, oh my God, turn that bridge down, right? There's so many colors, you know. And a product of the time, selling RCA televisions. Yeah, we get it. But I think it's a nice kind of subdued work environment where it's, you don't have to like, oh God, the red is like too much in my eyes. So I like, and this bridge, you know, is they continue it through 2 and 3, and then 4 they kind of repaint it, and then they completely redesign it for 5 and 6. But those are conversations for other times. But even of the movie bridges, you know, of the design exterior, right, of the ship, I like the NCC-1701 refit and the A, and the interior I like, you know, the motion picture 2 and 3 bridge. So those are my preferences when it comes to the bridge.
Yeah, there definitely is less red. The railings became chrome instead of the red. So, which I've never really noticed. And now that I think about it, you're like, yeah, they were red in the TV series, and then they're not anymore. So
it's much more nautical now, you know, than it ever was, and makes a lot of sense. And that's how things work normally. You know, I mean, things are much more subdued. A lot of it's for practicality and easy to paint back, you know, in our timeline, in their time, I'm not really so sure, but, you know, it has a really sleek, very functional, practical look to it, and makes a lot of sense. And that was the whole logic, I guess, of it was, you know, how do we make this look so believable and practical that, you know, it makes a lot of sense to people, and I think they did a good job with it.
Now, making our way down to main engineering, I did want to mention that they change where the phasers and photon torpedoes are, right, from the original series. And this is one of my favorite changes as well, because in the original series, I get that the phasers are coming out of that. Talk about domes, right, the bottom and top of the saucer. I get that the phaser emitter is like the dome at the bottom of the original Enterprise. I get that, right? And then it's like, fire torpedoes, and like torpedoes also kind of come out of there, apparently. That was always kind of confusing to me. I think it may be remastered. They play with that a little bit to kind of make a little more sense. DOS remastered. But I like the differentiation now, because, you know, actually the only original series movie where the Enterprise fires phasers is Star Trek II. And you see the little, like, you know, phaser emitters on the saucer section. That's cool. But the torpedoes now have moved down to like be the bridge on the neck between the saucer and the star drive section. And I like that a lot, because you think about, you know, everybody knows the classic shots in the Meyer movies where people, like, they're pulling up grates and loading torpedoes and that kind of thing. That makes sense to me, that, like, the torpedo, like, you know, assembly system will be down there in the star drive section, and then, like, in the long shoot through the battle bridge, whatever. They never really established what it was called, right? So I just go to my TNG terminology for that. But you just see, you know, I can just visualize, even like in a blueprint, like, okay, here's the torpedo launcher, here's the stuff, right? And to me, that make a lot of sense. And it just perfectly, like, it's a great kind of a joint between the two parts of the ship to have the torpedo launcher there. So I really like that change for this refit Enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think that made a lot of sense. And on the blueprints too, it did allow it to fire aft torpedoes. And so there's no obstruction there. Now, you don't really see a hole. You don't see anything where that could happen. But I just remember that being part of the blueprints.
Now, I remember Khan shouting, aft torpedoes fire, at some point. So we know the Reliant could do that, too.
Yeah, they do shoot. So they had that that really cool, you know, spoiler. Yeah, the spoiler where they had the same torpedo deck as the Enterprise, just above everything, which I thought was pretty neat. But you could see where, you know, now you could you could understand how they shoot out of the stern. And you know, in credit to the Next Generation, you know, they have that long tube that goes across the top of the secondary hull. I'm sorry, the primary hull, where it also can fire, you know, as we saw in the very first episode, torpedoes from astern. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. All right, Ken, we have reached engineering.
Engineering. Yeah. Yeah. You know, they put so much effort and so much money into this deck. I mean, it is so big. You know, it's four or five decks up and down. And when you look down, when Kirk looks down into the main antimatter chamber, how many decks that goes, that's incredible, and that flow of energy between the two. And then when they added the scale where you actually see the matter, antimatter, I'm not sure what exactly is going, but that energy that goes down the tube to the two nacelles, they hired actors at different heights, including children, so that the scale looked like it was going a really long way down the back of the primary hull up into the two engines. And so, you know, it was really hard in the original series to kind of understand the engineering section and how it worked, because all the tubings, pipes, everything was in a triangle, right? And it would go down in a triangle. So it was really hard to see how things worked. But in this case, I thought they did a really nice job of, bringing scale and modern technology into the play. I just haven't seen a set that has come close to matching what they did in the motion picture. Of course, no one's had the money or the budget until 2009 to do anything like that either.
You don't prefer the Anheuser-Busch factory to this, kid?
I don't like the Anheuser-Busch factory very much. And I would have to say that it was probably the biggest disappointment when The Next Generation aired. And, you know, I was like, really? Neon lights? You know, as we went from really cool engine. It's almost like we went backwards. I wasn't impressed at all with what they did with engineering. But you know, I thought the motion picture, they did it right.
Well, to your point there, I think, and I might be wrong about this, but I really think they just literally took the prop from motion picture and the whatever special effects light they had inside and used it for Voyager. Because as soon as Voyager started, I was like, that is the engineering from the motion picture. You know, the cloud-looking blue and purple waves and all that. Anyway, they were using so many props, like movies and TV shows back and forth in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. Like, they probably did. But anyway, speaking of the engineering set itself, I really like the horizontal branch-offs of the warp core. Because that makes sense. Like, where is this energy going? Right? It's going off to the side, to the nacelle. So that was really cool. And then, obviously, talking about the practicality, the environmental suits that everybody wore as well in engineering, it made you feel like this is a working place, you know, and it could be dangerous, so we need to protect ourselves. So, yeah, I love this engineering set.
Yeah, it's beautiful. I appreciate that, you know, they put in some elevators and they put in more ladders, which, I mean, that makes sense. Come on now. If you have this large set, how are you going to get around? Ain't nobody going to run upstairs. It's going to take too long.
And when they shot it all out in Star Trek II, you know, and how it kind of followed the trail as to, you know, where those main energy conduits existed, you know, they did it well there too. So they didn't take the time or effort in Star Trek II to give it the scale that it had in Star Trek the Motion Picture. But they used the exact same sets, and it worked out okay. You know, it worked out okay.
And I think ultimately, you know, the changes interior-wise, you know, for the Enterprise original and refit, I mean, it's just giving us, we have a budget now, we're the whole movie is set on the Enterprise, so we can explore this, we can extrapolate things that never got a chance to see before. You know, I mean, engineering from the original series looked different, like, all the time. You know, when you first got there, it was pretty empty. Some episodes that has all these giant things that, like, you know, like, enemy within, like, Evil Kirk's crawling on top of us. Like, what is this? Where are we? What's going on? spacey. You got these random pipes that you can pull out and beat up people when they take over engineering, you know. Yep. And then, like, in the third season, Scotty got, like, his second or third season, I forget, but Scotty got, the, like, a second level area. So it was just, it was always evolving, you know. And so it was nice to see, like, a fully formed, like, here's the way we would wish we could have presented it from day one to y'all. I mean, and even and even look at, like, Next Gen, right, when they had, like, stellar cartography, right? I believe in Lessons, right?
Yes.
The episode with Nella Darren, she's a stellar cartographer, right? It's like a room with like an island in the center of it, you know, and that's it. And then you go to Generations, like, okay, we have some money now. Let's build this awesome Cerebro stellar cartography set, right? And that's great. And then, of course, you get to Nemesis and they go back to just using a room, but that's a conversation for another time. But anyway, I just loved how expansive it was. And that's something that, you know, I love a lot of the interiors on the Kelvin timeline Enterprise. Like, you know, it's like an Into Darkness when Kirk and Spock are walking along, you see, like, corridors and crossways, and they really open everything up. And we just never got to really spend enough time on that Enterprise, I think. And that was what's great about the motion picture. And like you said, Ken, all the things you love so much, or maybe what made other people bored, I don't know. But I like that we got to really know this new Enterprise, which I think was appropriate because we had known the original Enterprise for you know, 3 years on TV, inside and out. And they're bringing us this new ship, which looks, it's kind of like the other one, but it's really different. So taking the time to, like, kind of reintroduce you to everything and familiarize you with everything and show off everything was really great and helped you, you know, as you guys were saying, kind of buy into the events of the actual story because you buy into the environment.
Yeah. So Roddenberry, he actually was considering redesigning the ship anyway because he was in this. At this point, it's phase two.
Yeah, the old sets were destroyed, so you might as well start over. Right?
Yeah,
that's right.
So he brings in Matt Jeffries, who kind of helped start this process along, and he actually worked on the original construction and design of the ship. In the article, he said that he actually had the nacelles were flat when he first drew them, so that kind of was where he was starting from with this redesign. But then phase two evolved into the movie, and Paramount brought in Robert Abel and associates to redesign this, and they've got Richard Taylor, and he was like, guys, we've just... So his quote in it is, he sat down with Roddenberry and Katzenberg and said, we are going to have to redesign the Enterprise because it needs to be armatured from six sides and it needs to have lighting systems in it. Also, if the camera is going to get close to the model, say up close to the windows, the model has to be big enough for us to give it detail. Trying to film a model that is too small is deadly. The focus, lighting, depth of field, surface textures, and much more come into play. The Enterprise ended up being almost 8 feet long, and the model that was under construction was maybe 4 feet long. So, I mean, they doubled the model in size.
Well, I think one of the other changes they made in between was when Matt Jeffries was still doing it. I went Starship Las Vegas a couple years ago. I got, like, a mini poster of this. As like the very first poster for the motion picture. It's kind of a hybrid between the movie and the show Enterprise.
Yes. You know?
So it has like
It's a cool poster.
Yeah, yeah, right, isn't it, right? So it has the movie nacelles, but it kind of has the original series deflector dish. And so I kind of like... And actually, I think Eagle Moss came out with a version of that, like a small model. Like, you know how they're running out of ships.
Potentially.
To do, right? So they're like...
Potentially.
They're like,
I mean, they've got
Let's
everything.
Do ships that never happen that people know about. Yeah, so I think they came out with that. If they really do have everything. Brandon would know. Brandon collects like every single one of those. Brandon Shamatella. So what do you guys think about the deflector dish? That's something I wanted to ask y'all. Do you like the radio deflector dish of the original series, or do you like the blue or gold one from the refit?
Oh. Go ahead, Haley.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the original series, the TV version of it.
You do, huh?
Yeah.
The newer version had a much more, I guess, modern feel. The satellite dish, to me, was always very old technology. And I was like, boy, they didn't modernize that piece of it. But it was, at least it was a familiar piece of technology. You know, you could understand what it was doing, even though, I always thought, as a kid, it was a receiver or, an antenna. where instead of a deflector. So I guess that the new approach with, you know, that energy, of course, you know, that deflector dish then became useful in the various TV shows as time went on, and even Generations, which we'll forget ever existed, but you know, where they use the deflector dish to do different things. It had more than just the ability to move objects away from the ship as it was traveling, that type of thing. So for me, I thought it added to the symmetry of the ship. I think that's the one thing about the motion picture Starship. Now, there is absolutely very little reason to make it more aerodynamic, but it's much more aerodynamic, right? And yeah. if you have an antenna or something like that that would actually, you know, stick out from the front like they did in the original series or whatnot, then in theory, you know, that would put up against a lot of resistance, where now, like, there's no air, there's nothing to push against, but at least it just kind of keeps with the symmetry of the ship, with everything being tight and kind of locked in. And, you know, again, it just seems to work for me.
Well, when you take the Enterprise, you know, underwater, Ken, I think it helps not to have that dish sticking out in front.
less barnacles and things to scrape off it.
Now, you know, and I think I might have been Red Shirt Starship when we talked about it, Ken, but I think you actually told me about how, because I was like, hey, it's blue, it's gold sometimes, what's the deal? And I think you're the one who told me, like, well, when the warp core is working correctly, it's blue, but when it's not, it's gold, or something like that. And so, again, like the practicality of using, you know, the design and stuff to, like, signify something that's working or whatnot with the ship. Because in motion picture, it's gold most of the time, and then all the rest of the movies, and at the end of motion picture, it's blue. I'm talking about the deflector dish on the refit. So anyway, there you go, deflector dish, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, something else I thought was interesting, Haley, which you mentioned from the article here, was how they tried to make it, like, kind of more of an Art Deco design, huh?
Yeah. Which I think you can see it. I like how Taylor said that the front end of the nacelles is almost like a 1940s Ford grill. And I'd have to look up a picture to see what that to see what a 1940 Ford grill looks like. Yeah. We'll take his word on that, I guess.
Tom Paris would know, because he knows all about 20th century vehicles.
Yeah, but, you know, you're mentioning about the color of the deflector dish, right? So they actually, the painting process on the model that they used, and I wonder if this is part of it, it was textured so that in different lighting, the ship looked a little different color. So I wonder if maybe that has something to do with it too, with the deflector dish looking different color, maybe part of the painting process.
If you get Paul Olson's book, or you listen to the episode, and Zach will tell you the episode number because he's got them all by heart.
This guy.
But I know it was January, I think last year, so it was just a year ago when I interviewed Paul, or maybe it was 2 years ago. Time goes by. But great, you know, the original team that put together the Enterprise and painted it and all of that are actually having this big, you know, fundraiser where they want to rebuild the Enterprise from scratch and make it much bigger, and they want to paint it the same way. But they use kind of this pearl color, and they literally painted, like, every single deck plate, you know, meticulously. So you're absolutely right, Haley. When the ship was you know, going through something or passing something, it was reflective of those colors. That's why the beauty of the ship was never captured that way again. And it was also because of the way they filmed it. They filmed it using a black screen, not a green screen. And using the black screen allowed them to capture the different colors and so forth. And when they made Star Trek II and III, ILM painted the ship white. They just painted it white because they used a green screen, and so the whole ship would look green if they were to use it with the way that they filmed. And it absolutely, you know, changed that piece of the ship. It became a much more sterile look, and they never really got it again. I mean, I think if you look at the way the motion picture was filmed, and then you see the same ship in Star Trek VI, it's like after all those years, they went backwards. They really went backwards. The ship did not have, you know, quite the look, and it wasn't as captivating. And it's funny how Yes, the design was there, the look was there from, you know, nothing changed on the ship other than they added the hyphen and the A. But wow, what a big difference. All those years of wear and tear put on that ship, and the fact that they never went back and attempted to film it the way that it really looked its best. And I'm sure that, you know, financially or whatever, it didn't make much sense to do it. But just it really, really impacted the look. And that's why the ship never looks the same after Star Trek II, because they use a lot of, obviously, shots from the motion picture in Star Trek II. And so you kind of got the... You've got two different Enterprises almost, and it's a real shame that they changed it that much. But that was the kind of time, effort, and money they put into this movie. I mean, to that level of detail, painting each and every section, because they also wanted to show that it had imperfections, you know, that things weren't always squared away, and you can always find a small defect here or there and whatever, because that's how ships are. And that's, I mean, to even think of it from that mindset to me is incredible, just incredible. And they did try to capture that in 09, but that was all computer generated, you know, the same idea.
No, I agree. It looked best in the motion picture, you know. I mean, the ship always looks great, but just the time and effort and, yeah, they were rushed. Their budgets kept getting slashed, so they were like, okay, let's just, you know, didn't have the time to go through the meticulous process they did with the first one. And it does show, even though it does look great in all six movies, it does show there is a clear difference, as you said, Kim, between when you see it in the motion picture and other places. But so while you were talking there, I looked it up because I do not have these things memorized. so Paul Olson, he was on Standard Orbit 157. There are no Star Destroyers in the Smithsonian. That was 2 years ago. That was January 2017.
2 years ago.
So time does fly.
Time does fly.
That's one of those reasons my kiddo and I want to take that trip back east. I told her about the model that's at the Smithsonian, and she just, like, eyes wide, mouth dropped, gasp, like, Mom, we have to go see that. I'm like, okay.
Yes. Hopefully the shutdown will be over by then.
Yeah. So I wanted to talk to you guys about this, and I found this really interesting. So Taylor brought in illustrator Andrew Probert, and he was a Trekkie. So he was working on different areas. He's the reason why the photon torpedo launcher changed, and he worked on the impulse engines. But he did something. He gave the ship landing gear. And this is a quote from the article. Popular opinion indicated that the two triangular points on the underside of the saucer were actually two landing legs, and the third one would be a telescoping leg in the dorsal support cavity. So the saucer would have tricycle landing gear for a planet landing. For the motion pictures Enterprise, I designed four landing pads on the underside of the saucer. What do you guys think about the Enterprise landing on a planet?
Well, I'd always wondered what those triangular things were at the bottom of the saucer section. I thought they were just like a design thing, you know, but now in my mind, I can see him just kind of like lowering down now, landing on a planet. Now, the original series Enterprise, you know, that's an emergency only. It might be like, to me, it works in an emergency only for these kind of big ships. For something like Voyager, right? It's designed for that smaller ship. It's a scout class vessel, I guess, maybe even the Federation terms, Starfleet terms. That's cool that little ships like that land and take off and all that. For Enterprise, I always see it as it's a one-way trip if you're going to land on a planet. But that is cool that they kind of thought that through. Because you don't want it just to crash like in Generations. You want it to actually have some kind of support. So you can, basically at this point, it becomes an old-school flying saucer. Right, the saucer section comes down, ramp comes down, they come down the thing. That's how I envision it in my head. So that's cool. They thought that through.
Yeah, he mentioned in the article that I guess Kirk had made some reference, said something to Scotty in the Apple about landing gear or something, and I'd have to go back and watch. And that's where this idea came from. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And it did mention about the saucer separating, and I was like, what?
Yeah, that's something.
But you never see it on film. But they did.
They mention that in the Apple. It's in Mr. Scott's Guide to the Enterprise. It's one of those, like, again, it's like a buzzard collector situation, I think, or it's like they come up with something later on, and like it's established in TNG, and they kind of like, oh, we said something kind of like that 20 years ago. Let's tie that together, which is cool, I think, when they can kind of tie these off comments together and make some kind of like the continuity in the design of Starship. So that's pretty cool. Now, we actually did get to see the Enterprise separate in Star Trek Continues in its final episode. And I thought, oh, cool. This makes sense. They're going to separate. The Star Drive section is going to get destroyed. That's why the new Enterprise looks totally different. No, they reassembled it, and it just I'm like, oh, okay. I thought you were good. Now, I love Star Trek Continues. Don't get me wrong. I've sung its praises many times on the show here, but I thought that was kind of a missed opportunity where they could have really explained why we got almost a totally new Enterprise. But anyway.
Yeah, but it also it does help explain how you can rebuild and redo the you could build an entirely new saucer section and attach it to the primary hull, or vice versa. So it does allow you to kind of plug and play all the different sections of the ship. If you think yes. about its design, even from the TV show to now, it has a whether by accident or by design, it's perfectly suited to be able to break up and save whole sections of the ship, you know, and it can function. You know, you can still maneuver, and you know, obviously they took that to a whole new level in the Next Generation, which was you know, its concept was great in that sense, that you know, you could send all the families and, you know, the goats and whatever else they have on that ship, you know, up in the saucer section, and everything's got to survive, and then they can go fight the battles with you know, with just the stern section. But you know, it's funny, they never really did that, and I always thought that was kind of interesting in DS9, where all the Galaxy class ships, you know, they all came intact, mm-hmm. You know, into those major battles. So the saucer section did have plenty of weaponry of its own, so to speak. But they kept talking about, once removed from its bulk, it is quite a weapon, you know.
Yeah, and, I remember Worf says that at some point. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. So I thought that was kind of neat. But I mean, I think all of that started, you know, with just those comments from the Apple. But the ship itself, I mean, it is very practical, and in, you know, and beyond, they also showed you how it's a strength and a weakness. You know, there's always mm-hmm. a trade-off. There's always yeah. a trade-off.
So there's actually a diagram in Mr. Scott's Guide to the Enterprise where you see, like, you know, it's like a 4-point diagram where you see like the saucer separate and then it lands on the planet. You know, and it's like they should have shown that to them in Generations. Maybe they wouldn't have crashed so hard on the planet. Just saying. So.
Yeah, well, you know, not everybody. I have that book. Yeah, no, that was actually a very good book. It came out, I think, like around Star Trek 2 or 3 timeline or something, right? The original. Is it Mr. Scott's Guide to the Enterprise? Yeah, it was the new ship. It was the refit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I do have that.
So, have you guys ever noticed Mickey Mouse in the window?
No, I saw that they had, but no, they mentioned in this article here that they put windows on the ship, which is great, because I always thought they really added a lot of realism to it, because you get close enough to the ship, because in the original series, you never got close enough for the model to see this, but you get close enough to the refit Enterprise, you can kind of see inside. I'm like, that's really cool. There's a whole world going on in there. That's really nice. I didn't realize that there were pictures of Mickey Mouse in there, though. So.
Yeah, so when they did that, they put in these transparent images inside the windows, because when you got up close, it would actually look like stuff was going on inside these windows, even if it wasn't a particular part of the ship that necessarily we're going to see inside of once you go into an actual set. Yeah, so there's Mickey Mouse. Apparently Andy Probert was in there, and then some others that were involved. I'm like, I'm going to look out for Mickey Mouse and see if I can't find him now.
Well, great. Now Disney is going to sue Paramount. Thanks for bringing this to their attention.
Yeah, so that was
Disney does not screw around with their copyright, okay? Like, I've seen daycares that have to, like, repaint their facades because they painted something that looked too much like Mickey Mouse. So they do not screw around with this stuff. Yeah. Maybe JJ can smooth that
Don't
over.
Don't mess with Disney.
You know, so because he works on both sides now, so he can smooth that over.
So one final thing. No,
yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead, Ken.
I was just going to say, now Disney can send out fleets and fleets of Star Destroyers after the poor Enterprise if they have Mickey Mouse in there. That's one thing they now have the ability to do. But I did, you know, one of the things that I thought was really cool in the motion picture is that, you know, especially towards the end, where they go towards the bottom of the primary hull, you can see the botanical gardens, you know, that they were talking about, right? I mean, you have there's like a row of four or five big windows that you can see in. And after the motion picture, they just made those big black squares. Like, they got rid of those really kind of cool windows that you could see into the ship, which I thought was always, again, another thing where you go, oh, okay, you know, this
lazy.
This will allow them to, yeah, well, you know, I know they didn't have the budget, but I always argue, you know, Star Trek II and Star Trek III, if they didn't put the time and effort to build all the stuff they did in the motion picture, they could never have made those movies. Because they said, oh, we did it at, you know, a tenth the cost. I said, yeah, but you did it on sets that were already built for you. So you didn't have the cost involved to create it in the first place. So it's not like you weren't just brilliant at being economical. You had stuff that was already bought, paid for, and written off. So you're good, you know. So the ability to do it for a lot cheaper has been, to me, it's like, yeah, you can do things a lot cheaper when you have, you know. It's like you can get somebody else's car and say, you know, I didn't spend as much money as a car as you did. It's like, no, you were given it. You know, you have it, so have fun with it. You know, all they had to do was paint it and change things the way to make the directors feel better, or, you know, to have a different look, which they did a nice job with. But yeah, it was just a lot of those cool things where in the motion picture you don't see again after the motion picture with the ship.
Well, and I think, you know, a lot of us, we appreciate those little details, and it is those little details that make it wonderful, right? Because you would imagine that, yeah, I want to be able to see inside the windows. It's not just, I mean, is there a force field that prevents you from looking inside? You can only see when you're looking out the window. I mean, and so those little details are really what make it, I think. So that's kind of, you know, that's really great that they did that. So one last thing, and I think this is really neat, and I'm wondering if whoever was working on the Kelvin films saw this or heard about this, and this is why we have it. So Taylor, he wanted to have the warp engines generate an obvious energy field. So he designed the nacelles. That's why they have the panels and they light up all the way down. This was abandoned before the film was released, but we do get that in the Kelvin film. So we get that, like, he says it, we would have had that streak when the ship was in motion. So what do you guys think? I mean, we see it in the original series and in the show itself sometimes. And then we see it in the Kelvin film. There's that blue, like, and it makes a noise.
The trail,
well, it probably doesn't make a noise because there's no sound in space. But, you know, the ship takes off in the Kelvin films and we have that streak behind it.
Yeah, like the warp trail. Yeah. Speaking of changes between motion picture and the other ones, like, there are some shots even where you can kind of see it kind of look a little blue. And I'm like, oh, is this... Like, is it supposed to be lit up? Is this a reflection of V'ger? What is this? But no, originally they were supposed to, like, it's just a light up and have some energy to them. So that's another, as you said, they kind of pick it up again in, like, TNG, where they have the blue band around the nacelles and that kind of thing. So I don't know. We see so many ships. It's just because it's what I'm used to. We see so many more movies with the Enterprise and other ships like this where they don't have any kind of, like, energy coming off them. I'm kind of used to just being, like, a dull piece of, you know, metal, as opposed to something with illumination.
Well, I thought it was a pretty cool aspect of the ship. I don't know if you were talking about in Beyond, Haley, where the you know, you actually see the ship in a warp bubble, right, and everything's moving around it. And Beyond was the first time they actually kind of, you see graphically how the warp bubble works in The Next Generation. You get an idea of how it's supposed to function. Well, you really saw that for the first time ever in Beyond, right? It was the first time they showed warp speed as envisioned, I think. You know, you have the different methods. You have, from the original show, the ship just accelerates and the stars move by faster. In the motion picture, you have this incredible event when it goes into warp speed with, you know, it actually, you know, forming that bubble around it with a big explosion, and it's really cool with all the lights and the spectrum coming after you. Then again, they abandoned it in the next few movies where it's just a trail of lights.
You can get sucked into a wormhole, Ken. So, I mean, I'll take the more boring approach if we don't have to go into slow motion and use photon torpedoes. instead of phasers. Oh,
you know what? You just, you know, you're such a Captain Dunsel. You just don't, you don't like any challenges. You just want to make sure when you come to work every day, the coffee's warm and you don't have to worry about anything. Come on, where's your sense of adventure? I mean, if you can't get thrown up against an asteroid because your engines are imbalanced, what the hell kind of life is that? Boring.
Channeling the warp drive and the phasers together, interesting. You know, I think it was only for that one plot point or whatever. But I guess if the biggest power generator on the ship is the warp engine, so if you want more powerful phasers, I guess it makes sense to channel them to the warp engine. So I can at least understand why that would be a thing. So.
Yeah, I guess what I liked about the motion picture when it finally went to warp speed and it's moving along, there is no trail, right? When it's at warp 1 through 7, it's just traveling through space and the stars are zipping by, right? And that's right back to where you were in the original series, which was pretty cool. And they never did that again, really. When they went to warp speed, there was always a trail behind the ship or whatever in the rest of the movies. TNG kind of met it halfway. You know, they had kind of this, you know, the ship becomes elongated. Rubber band effect, right? Goes into warp. But then the stars are lined streaking past, which I always thought was a really cool effect, right? Because you know the difference between when you're truly traveling at warp and when you're not. And then in the JJ films, as much as I like those films, they just, you know, okay, whatever the Millennium Falcon did, we do, right?
Punch
we
go it.
Into this, yeah, we just punch it and we're in this big blue thing or whatever. Still doesn't make any sense to me because they completely lost the point of it. And then, you know, in Beyond, I thought they brought it full circle to where it was supposed to graphically kind of look like. So I love the effect. I thought, you know, again, when you have that money and that attention to detail, the warp effect, which, you know, think about it, they put that together. They were filming that in 77 and 78. Looks better than what they're doing with CGI today. I mean, it actually looks better. When that thing goes into warp drive, that is the coolest special effect I think they've done in any of the Star Trek films. You know, it just, and it adds that level of suspense, you know, because it was such a, up, go to warp speed, no big deal. And in the movie, it became a big deal. Never is again, really. But it was kind of neat, you know. This is something to really consider here, you know.
And so I also he wanted that streak though, and they didn't have it, but he did want it there. And so it's interesting that we get it afterwards in the rest of them and in the Kelvin films. We have that visible blue streak, at least in the Kelvin films. It's that blue sparkly whatever glitter in space.
Right, right. You have it in the wormhole, so to speak, but you don't have it beyond that. No, you're absolutely
right. Well, this has been fun, guys. I learned a lot in this, and it was really fun and interesting to see the differences between the original series and then the refit. Kind of fun. And I'm going to look out for Mickey Mouse next time I watch the motion picture.
Yes. Yeah. So is Iger.
That's right.
So, yeah, it's going to be interesting because we know those guys listen to this podcast, so. Mm-hmm. We might have ratted them out because they probably missed it. You know, I don't know how old Bob Iger is. He's probably just a little older than me. Maybe he never read Star Trek the magazine. And of course, who was the when you look,
Michael Eisner?
No.
Katzenberg.
Katzenberg worked on this movie.
Yeah.
Right, and became a pretty senior executive at Disney as well, mm-hmm. over time. So he probably, you know, didn't share that information either, because he would have been in trouble.
Well, R2-D2 is in the Kelvin timeline. He's in Star Trek 09, you know, floating in like the Vulcan debris. So JJ knew. He knew what he was doing. So.
Oh, I thought he got blown out at the beginning when the Kelvin was attacked.
I don't know. Actually, I've never actually spotted him myself. So I can't.
I think
speak
I did. I
it,
think I went looking for him and I found him. I was. Yeah, yeah. It is funny how they do those little things in movies. It's and of course they did that on the displays of the next gen set all the time, which I thought is pretty funny when you step away.
Yeah.
And they talk about what they were, you know, all the inside jokes. It's kind of fun.
All right. Well, the refit of the Enterprise in Star Trek the Motion Picture isn't the only thing we've been talking about this week. Here's a quick look at what else you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, to the journey! Braised Prune Pantyhose. Okay, if I'm going to make a commitment to myself right now. If I am ever perishing in a plane crash, I am going to say brace for impact right before I die to everyone on the plane.
I will
brace
somehow for impact. Hear it across the miles.
It'll be very dramatic, you know, with some dramatic theme music playing, hopefully, just like we have in Voyager here this episode.
Earl Grey.
That's terrible. Wow. Like, why would someone think that? I mean, if it's going to infect this entire world of Ferengi, you've got to assume that there's going to be visitors or whatever, and that it's just going to spread everywhere.
Spread
that
everywhere.
Doesn't even make sense.
Doesn't sound like a good plan.
No,
to me.
It does not.
Literary Treks.
Both Bound and myself like Star Trek stories that work as some kind of a parable that hold up the mirror to modern times. And when we got the assignment that we could actually write the Prometheus trilogy, we were pretty sure that we wanted to do something contemporary with it, that we wanted to put modern day into a science fiction story. And the biggest problem that we saw at the time was terrorism.
Melodic Treks.
You know, I suppose as being an actor, you know, I just was really kind of feeling into Clive's character. Okay. And trying to express the emotion of what I felt like he was going through on the Sarangi. Mm-hmm. So then it became much more of a personal, individual character. It was how I experienced doing it.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, get the show on iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well.
If you would like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trekfm.com/contact. And look in the sidebar on the show page. Or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at @trekfm, Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and the Babel Conference. Type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trekfm and click discussion on the menu bar.
Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our associate producers for Standard Orbit. They are Norman C. Lau, Nick Anastasio, Tim Robertson, Richard Marquez, Corey Elrod, and Dan Rhodes. You guys, your contributions, your help, your support mean the world to us, and we appreciate you being associate producers on Standard Orbit. So to find me on the interwebs, you can find me on the Babel Conference. I'm there all the time. Or you can find me on Twitter at BostonSCPO.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreOnCach. And I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Holding On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S.
You can find me on Twitter. I am at Trekkie01D.
Celebrating Trek Tuesdays. That's tomorrow, everybody. Wear your Trek.
Yes, and use the hashtag Trek Tuesday.
So thanks, everyone, for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.